This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us on our Main Street June 4th today as we celebrate a beautiful day across most of North Dakota. And I guess we can also celebrate the fact that there are lots of kids out of school because this is the summer that they've been waiting for months. So our main streets are filling up with kids, and we're going to talk about kids because we got a fun contest to share with our listeners today. Ashley Thornburg is with me, back from vacation in Hawaii. Welcome back.
Thank you. Haven't been snorkeling yet today. It's a little weird.
Well, the red is a little cool. Christine McClellan is Prairie Public's Community Engagement Manager. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to talk about the PBS Kids Writers Contest, which just wrapped up, I guess.
Huh? Yeah, well, it wrapped up at the end of March. We do this every year. This is actually our 24th Writers Contest, so we've been doing it for a long time. We do it every spring, and usually we accept stories beginning of January through kind of the end of March, and then we judge them and pick our winners.
So it's kindergarten through third graders, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah, and we get entries from all over North Dakota, some in Minnesota, Montana, Winnipeg. So, yeah, they're really from all over.
I know the PBS version's been going on 24 years. You've been with Prairie Public a couple years now.
Yeah.
Has the competition grown over the years?
Yeah, I mean, when I was looking up when we started it, they started out just getting like 75 entries, kind of under 100. But this year we got 330. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's grown quite a bit, which is good.
What's the purpose of the contest? I mean, there must be some sort of an educational mission here, right?
Oh, of course, yeah. Just encouraging kids' creativity. You know, a lot of the time they'll write stories for school or for some sort of purpose, but this is just kind of like an extracurricular fun thing for them to do, and they can really do whatever they want. It's really open-ended for what they want to write about, what kind of illustrations or pictures or drawings they want to include. And I think it's really fun for them to be in a contest, like a PBS contest, and since they recognize the PBS name, of course.
Well, let's give our listeners just a sample of what these stories are like, because we've got some very cute stories to share. Kennedy Riggins from Watford City was the kindergartner who won.
Yeah, so we choose a winner for each grade level. So there's a kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and third grade winner. And this year is the first year that we've asked them to send in audio recordings of them reading the story, which I think was a wonderful idea, and we want to keep doing that. So yeah, Kennedy Riggins was our winner in kindergarten.
Well, her story is Elisa the Unicorn.
Elisa the Unicorn by Kennedy. Once upon a time, there was a magical unicorn named Elisa. Her hair was pink and purple with gold. Elisa the unicorn was magical because she could turn into a rainbow. One day, Elisa went to town and gave kids in the hostel candy.
What?
The kids hugged her. Elisa hugged the kid back and told them to always be happy. Elisa also got her family candy. The kids were so happy they were screaming and cheering. This day made Elisa so happy that she turned herself into a rainbow. Everybody but Cannon got candy because Cannon was sick, and candy would make him more
even
more sick. Cannon was sad. So Elisa turned her into her, herself into a rainbow to make him happy. Cannon still didn't get candy, but he was happy. The end.
That's Kennedy Rickens of Watford City, Elisa the Unicorn. I can imagine the illustrations with this story because I think she was maybe reciting some illustrations as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're very colorful. And I should say that you can see all of these stories on our website, prairiepublic.org. We've scanned them so you can see the original drawings and read them yourself.
Well, Kennedy, I wish Elisa could come visit us at work.
Well, there's a curricular connection here, though. I mean, this is a kindergartner who's written a story.
Uh-huh. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it really shows them to exercise their creativity and their writing skills and drawing skills. And, I mean, reading the story out loud, too, is even more so.
Do you have a sense, is this just completely kids or kids and parents submitting on their own? Or is there maybe sometimes a classroom element where a teacher says, class, we're doing this as a project?
Yeah, we really reach out to, I mean, we mailed to all the teachers in North Dakota and our broadcast area to encourage their classes to do this. It's not necessarily required in all these classrooms, but a lot of the times the teachers will just hang up a poster on the wall and kids who want to enter can. But yeah, we encourage teachers to mention it to their classrooms and even include it in their curriculum too.
Do you hear back from the kids?
Yeah, well, so I call every one of them to let them know that they win. So yeah, they're always very excited. And
that's got to be fun duty.
Oh yeah, it's really fun.
Well, let's get another sample here because this next one has a great title. This is for grade one, Cole Anderson of Marion, North Dakota, and the title of his story is Invisible Sweatpants.
Brett Jeans and the Invisible Sweatpants by Cole Anderson, first grade. Alone, that's where Brett sat. Whether on the bus, at lunch, or in gym class, Brett sat alone. Until his aunt, Nia, brought him a present. Think you want Nia, but invisible sweatpants? Invisible sweatpants give you superpowers, Nia said. Brett wears invisible sweatpants, ha ha ha, the children sang. In math class, no one wanted to be his partner. But practice was different. First, no one could see his leg, so Brett scored the winning goal. Then, Brett blocked all the pucks at hockey. Finally, the quarterback threw a Hail Mary to Brett, and he caught it. Brett wears invisible sweatpants, hooray, the children cheered. That afternoon, Brett pulled a prank. He hid in a tree. With his legs hanging down, his invisible legs bonked his neighbor, Ron, giving him a black eye. Everyone laughed at Ron. Brett, said Aunt Nia, when you have great power, you must control it. You must use it for good. So the next day, Brett, Chance, and his invisible sweatpants asked Ron to be his partner at math. The end.
Well, that's a sweet story.
Yeah.
With a little moral to it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really impressive, the storytelling abilities of some of these kids. It's like, wow.
You said these are judged. Mm-hmm. Who takes a look at these and what are you looking for?
Yeah, so we kind of prejudge a lot of them. And then we have final judges. So there are stories that make it into the final round. And so we get judges. We got the children's librarians from the Fargo Public Library, our former education services director, Bev, and then we got a MSUM professor named Sharon Scapple. So they came in and they get a rubric that they judged it on storytelling, creativity, originality, a couple more elements, and kind of grade them and kind of score them. And so that's how they choose the winners.
And we have a story here about a kid who's lonely, who gets a special present from his Aunt Mia, invisible sweatpants, and decides that although he can do bad things with him, he wants to do good things with his invisible sweatpants. So apparently they've been given a little bit of instruction about how to tell a story. I went online. PBS mm-hmm. has some guidelines up there
yeah.
if classes and teachers want to use them, mm-hmm. sort of how to structure a story, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think they just kind of naturally know how a lot yeah. of it. I mean, they read all these children's books and watch PBS or any other TV programs, and they kind of understand what the structure of a story is and putting a moral to a story. And yeah, it's really impressive.
Well, let's get another sample here. This is from grade 2 by Caleb Zur of Grand Forks. The title of Caleb's story is The Adventures of Circle and Square.
The Adventures of Circle and Square by Caleb Zur, who is in second grade. One day, Square was mining and found an interesting crystal. He decided to give it to the museum since they were opening a new exhibit and were asking for donations. Square found Circle and asked if he should donate the crystal. Circle thought it was a great idea, so they put it away so they could give it to the museum the next day. But when they put it in the safe, they didn't notice Triangle watching. Triangle wanted to steal the crystal and sell it so he could make a ton of money. Triangle wrote down the password so he could remember it. Once Circle and Square were asleep, Triangle snuck in and took it. The next day, Square woke up and got to get the crystal out of the safe so he could give it to the museum. But when he looked in the safe, it wasn't there. He thought about who could have taken it and came up with who the suspects were. He thought it was Triangle and his boss, Bob. When Square told Circle about what happened, Circle started looking for his map. The map showed where Triangle's house was. When they found it, they started their journey. When they got to Triangle's base, there was a guard. They got in a big fight, which was a bad idea because Circle and Square got caught. Right as the guard took them in a cage, Circle grabbed a stick. When the guard put them in the cage, he left the keys hanging on the wall. Once he was gone, Circle used the stick to get the keys. When they got out, they went to Triangle's house. Once they were in, they searched the house and found the room with the crystal in it. There were lots of other stolen things in the room, like the Statue of Shapes, a few paintings, even Circle's rocket ship. Circle took the stuff that was stolen and put it in the rocket. Then Square got in the rocket with Circle and they flew back home. The end.
All right, that is Caleb Zur of Grand Forks with The Adventures of Circle and Square. I just noticed that in all three of these stories so far, there's been an element of magic and fantasy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting to see the themes, the similar themes through all of the stories. Like, the first story we had was Elisa the Unicorn. We got a ton of stories about unicorns this year.
Really?
It must be a new thing. And, yeah, a lot of, like, magic and fantasy and very imaginative stories.
You can see a little bit how kids' brains work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this story, The Adventures of Circle and Square, if you go online to read it, you'll see that his art style is a little bit different than a lot of the other entries in that he did a comic strip style. So he has a bunch of comic strips that kind of have like speech bubbles and tell the story that way.
So kind of a graphic novel approach to storytelling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I also noticed, because we've now heard three, kindergarten, first and second grade, that there is a clear progression in ability
mm-hmm.
in terms of putting sentences together, complex sentences with bigger words and plot devices and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting to compare them side by side like that because you can see how much they learn every year.
Well,
we have one more, right?
Yes, we do. This one is Bill Thomas in a discussion with one of the authors. He is talking with Jacob Day of Fargo, and Jacob's story, and Jacob is in grade 3, was The Adventures of Chicken.
The Adventures of Chicken by Jacob Day. It was a bright summer day, and a chicken leg named Chicken was wandering around Bok Bok's chicken buffet. Bok Bok's had mashed potatoes and gravy, macaroni, pizza, and chicken. Chicken had never been on the buffet counter and wondered what was up there. One day, he came up with a plan to get on the buffet counter. Chicken went to the table in the far back corner, which had a lot of gum under it, 37 pieces to be exact. He took some gum, two forks, a spoon, and a rubber band and made a catapult. Once Chicken made the catapult, he launched himself on the counter, landing right in the gravy. Chicken swam around and thought it was really fun. Eventually, Chicken got tired swimming in the gravy and climbed up the scoop. When he was walking on the counter, he fell on the pizza. For some reason, the pizza was bouncy. Chicken felt like he was on a giant trampoline. Once Chicken was bored, he bounced off the pizza and into the chicken wings. The chicken wings got mad at Chicken for landing on a wing and began chasing him. Chicken ran until he saw a piece of pizza on the ground. He jumped towards the pizza, but face-planted an inch left to the pizza. Most of the chicken wings face-planted, too. Chicken was wondering if chicken wings even had faces, but ran to the bathroom so he didn't get tackled by wings. Once Chicken got into the bathroom, he climbed to a toilet. When the wings came in, they began climbing the toilet as well. Chicken began running around, panicking and screaming, "Buck, buck." While running around the seat, he fell into the toilet. Just then, a chicken leg wearing a jetpack and top hat flew in to help. His name was apparently Top Hat Monkey Chicken. Eventually, Top Hat Monkey Chicken and Chicken escaped the wings and started a rock and roll band called Chicken Rock. Buck, buck. The end.
Can I ask you some questions about the book?
Sure.
Okay. So I'm talking to Jacob, who wrote the book, which is called The Story, The Adventures of Chicken. And one of the things I wondered is... how did you get the idea? Most of the stories we get in the contest, people draw the pictures. How did you get the idea of using photographs?
I thought that the pictures might look a little funnier.
Uh-huh. They do look pretty funny. And what's your? Do you have a favorite picture in there?
I like the last one where they are in a band.
Yeah, and... was there something specific that made you think of having them end up in a rock and roll band?
No.
That's just an idea that came. Yeah, that picture is kind of the most sort of complicated one. It's got a lot going on in it. But the other pictures are funny. It's really funny to see a chicken leg with eyes. Was that hard to do?
Not really.
No? How long did it all take to put together?
Maybe an hour, maybe.
Uh-huh. Okay. Did you write the story first and then do the pictures to go with it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And you've written other stories, right?
Yes.
So what other stories have you written? Can you tell me about any of them?
I used to write about crayons. One time I wrote about a Santa.
Uh-huh. Have you written other stories about food?
No.
But this story was good enough to win.
Yeah.
The Adventures of Chicken by Jacob Day of Fargo, interviewed by our Bill Thomas, the director of radio for Prairie Public. He used a couple of interesting words for a third grader, buffet and catapult.
Yeah, I know. Very kind of advanced. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of good details. There were specific how many pieces of gum were under the bench there.
Yeah.
And that the chicken would wear a top hat. I love it.
And that would be Top Hat Monkey Chicken?
Yes.
Yes.
That's the one.
Top Hat Monkey Chicken. I would probably go see that band. Would you guys go see that?
Oh, totally.
Band?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what's in it for the winners here? I mean, bragging rights, I take it?
Yeah. So, well, of course, they get to be on the radio now. That's a new prize. And we do send them prizes from Barnes & Noble. We get them some books and gift cards and just kind of like usually like crayons or something like that. And they also get a certificate. Everyone who enters gets a certificate of achievement.
Do you want to share the names of all the other Red Ribbon winners, I guess?
Yeah, so our Red Ribbon favorites are kind of like our runners-up. So we choose three for each grade level. So kindergarten, our Red Ribbon favorites are Isabella Hernandez from Watford City with her story Sparkles Saves the Princess. Bray Hartley from Center, North Dakota with Sunshine and Rainbow. And Asna Omar from Bismarck, North Dakota with If You Give a Bear Honey. And our grade one Red Ribbon favorites are Sam Higby from Underwood, North Dakota with Max's Journey Around the World, Brooke Almond from Sykeston, North Dakota with The Three Lonely Girls, and Maya Neese from Carrington, North Dakota with The Lonely Dolphin. Grade 2 Red Ribbon favorites, Carlisha Holin from Mapleton, North Dakota with Apple and Jill. Alexandra Krebs from Bismarck, North Dakota with The Lost Little Jaguar. And Hayden Boutain from Goodridge, Minnesota with Weather Girl versus Mr. Freeze. And then grade 3 Red Ribbon favorites are Caitlin Vetter from Linton, North Dakota with Wings of the Sky. Justin Smith from Harvey, North Dakota with Dinosaur King. And Hope Gravely from Minot, North Dakota with The Dragon's Egg. And those are all also on our website to read if you would like to.
And again, our first place winners in kindergarten, Kennedy Riggins of Watford City, grade 1, Cole Anderson of Marion, North Dakota, grade 2, Caleb Zier, Grand Forks, and grade 3, Jacob Day of Fargo. And how can people read these stories online again?
So go to our website, prairiepublic.org, and it's right under our Kids and Events tab on our menu there.
All right, because these, again, are illustrated.
Yes, yeah, and the last one has photos, so that's really fun to look at.
And there's another event coming up that's kind of important for kids, the Share a Story event.
Oh, yeah, yep. So, yeah, that's this Saturday, June 9th at Roll Farm. It's 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. We also do this every year, usually in the beginning of June, and there's a bunch of free activities and food and stage entertainment. We have the Buffalo River Dancers and the Steel Drum Band from MSUM there. And there's going to be some really fun STEM-related activities. And also Daniel Tiger, the PBS Kids character, will be there, too.
Just a reminder that Prairie Public is radio and television and education, mm-hmm. and kids are really a big part of what we do here.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Christine McClellan, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett.
And we are co-hosts of Away with Words. My background is in classical languages, and I never expected that I would be doing something every single day with ancient Greek, which is why I went into journalism. But this job combines both of those things in a really wonderful way.
I used to be a journalist as well, and an editor and an IT guy, but I've always had an interest in language, and I had an opportunity to join the American Dialect Society and eventually become an editor of dictionaries for Oxford University Press, where I specialized in new words and slang. So you bring Martha's classical stuff with my new novel stuff, and I think we kind of cover the gamut of what has happened and has happened in English.
I don't really think it's a challenge to make this topic interesting to people because we all speak language, we all share stories, and people are a lot more curious about this than they realize. They might think initially, oh, this show isn't going to be interesting.
Yeah, they think it's two stuffy grammarians with corduroy jackets and patches on their elbows, but we're not cobwebby old school marks. Join us every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain for Away with Words on member-supported Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. Coming up on our show, a Natural North Dakota essay from Chuck Lura about Fort Stevenson State Park and a Cutting Ed podcast featuring an innovative high school English teacher. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. School safety, especially in the classroom, could be a big issue again as teachers sit down with school boards to negotiate contracts. That issue became contentious during last year's negotiations in some school districts.
It was one of the most compelling issues that drove Fargo and Bismarck to impasse, in fact.
Nick Archuleta is the president of North Dakota United, which represents teachers.
Anecdotally and factually, teachers are seeing more and more student behaviors that imperil not just themselves or the education support professionals with whom they work, but also other students.
In the Fargo district, by the end of April for the 2017 and 2018 school year, there were 510 reports of students physically assaulting a teacher or other school employee. That was up from 341 in the 2016-2017 school year.
As I was going around the state talking with teachers, is that they understand, just like most North Dakotans understand, that the most important thing that a school district has to be responsible for is providing a safe learning space for those children. Well, that safe learning space is the same workspace as teachers. So if you can't provide one, you're not providing the other because it's exactly the same space.
Archuleta says in Bismarck, a committee was set up between teachers and the administration to discuss it further and document reported incidents. The Senate Agriculture Committee is expected to release its farm bill draft in the coming days, and a bipartisan group of senators is looking to add $10 million worth of federal grants to that bill in order to help farmers who are grappling with mental health issues. Many rural areas lack adequate hospitals and health care services. The money would help boost or create counseling services, helplines, support groups, and outreach efforts at a time when rural suicide rates are higher than those in urban areas. Josie Rudolphy is an associate research scientist with the National Farm Medicine Center. She says the grants could be used in creative ways.
People gather around faith-based organizations, commodity groups, social groups, and so providing resources to these types of organizations might be more impactful than putting mental health providers in every county.
The bill was first introduced in April. And tomorrow has been declared a day without plastic bags in Fargo, Moorhead, West Fargo, and Dilworth. It's aimed at increasing awareness about the adverse effects of plastic bags, reducing their use, adapting to more eco-friendly bags, and increasing the amount of plastic bags that are now recycled. Laura Westberg is coordinator of the FM Plastic Bag Task Force.
So we've contacted grocery stores to see how many bags they're using annually, and we've had waste sorts to see if the public knows about plastic bag recycling. Additionally, we've worked to increase public awareness on these issues by producing residential guides and making sure that the city of Fargo and the city of Moorhead have accurate information about what plastic can be recycled and where it can be recycled.
Data gathered by the task force found that on average, a Fargo-Moorhead grocery store goes through about 52,400 pounds of plastic bags a year. Most plastic bags are only used for 12 minutes. A typical household will use 500 to 1,000 bags a year, and only about 2% of those are recycled. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Miles Spencer-Watson.
My name is Iris Bistongi.
My name is Kiani Marshall.
And I'm Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps. Interview someone you love. Join tens of thousands of American voices in our archive at the Library of Congress.
StoryCorps will be in Bismarck, June 28th through July 27th. You'll be able to make a reservation and schedule your interview starting June 14th.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Natural North Dakota is the name for a series of essays about where we live. Chuck Lura writes and voices Natural North Dakota, and he teaches biology at Dakota College at Bottineau. Today, his topic is Fort Stevenson State Park.
Some people may associate Fort Stevenson State Park with fishing, but even though the park lies along the shores of Lake Sakakawea, just south of Garrison, there's much more to see and do here than fish. The park's named for an old military fort from the 1800s. The fort was established along the shore of the Missouri River in the 1860s and operated until the 1880s. The river's course has changed, however, so the actual site is now under Lake Sakakawea, a couple miles to the southwest of the park. Like most other state parks, Fort Stevenson has a visitor center, campgrounds, cabins, as well as picnic areas and playgrounds. And for those of you that have an urge to get out on the water, the park has two marinas. Fishing, of course, is popular on Lake Sakakawea, where anglers may catch a wide variety of fish, including salmon, walleye, northerns, catfish, and smallmouth bass. If exploring the Lake Sakakawea shoreline is of interest, you could observe a seam of lignite or petrified wood. There's also a chance of seeing the globally threatened piping plover, a close relative of the killdeer. There are over 8 miles of hiking trails and explore the park. If you take Purple Coneflower Trail, you'll want to stop at the Interpretive Outlook, where you can look over the lake through a large scope. There's also a short interpretive trail and a short arboretum trail. Interesting plants in the park's plant checklist include Solomon seal, ball cactus, wild bergamot, buffalo berry, wild plum, catnip. There's also some native mixed grass prairie in the park. Expect to see big and little bluestem, blue grama, side oats grama, needle and thread, and depending on the season, pasque flower or wild beard tongue, purple coneflower, prairie coneflower, and dotted gay feather. Throughout the park, there's a good chance of observing mammals, such as deer or perhaps fox and coyote. There's also a wide variety of both game and non-game birds. And if by chance the mammals and the birds seem to be uncooperative, even if they are cooperative, be sure to visit the prairie dog town on the west side of the park. That's always good entertainment. So give some consideration to exploring Fort Stevenson State Park this summer. And as you prepare for the trip, it's probably best to take your fishing gear along. I'm Chuck Lehrer.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, providing caregiving resources, healthy living information, tips for families to avoid scams, and connecting with communities at fun events. They're creating real possibilities here in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Building human rights museums, lecturing on rape culture, might be surprising activities for high school English students, which is why it's the subject of a cutting-edge podcast. Eric Sanders teaches an innovative English class at Red River High School in Grand Forks, and today he visits with Tom Gerhart, host of the Cutting Edge podcast.
Well, tell me about the innovations class, how long you've been doing it now, and what you've noticed from students, the takeaway since you started, how you've seen them learn and maybe be more excited about learning.
Oh, this is the third year we've had it. It's been a semester course. Next year, it'll be a full year. So I'm very excited about that. And I know that there was a lot of potential there because every semester we'd be done and the kids would say, why is this not a full year? I should be doing this the whole time. And there's that. And I also had a lot of kids, we give a TED Talk at the end of the semester. And I had a lot of kids who got it, and I'm doing air quotes, I know we're on a podcast, but they got it, and they would tell us how they got it. And I'd say, oh boy, that's great. But getting it, and then getting it, and then doing it for an entire semester more is a huge difference. So I had kids who felt pretty confident in themselves and thought that they could go and be innovative and do things, but they didn't have that practice and that knowledge of accomplishment of what they've done. And so having this full year ahead is going to be really exciting.
You use project-based learning in your junior English class, you mentioned. And I'm fascinated by this human rights museum that you've created. Tell me about that and a takeaway from that.
So in thinking about how we need to get these skills of creativity, problem solving, and using projects to learn and not just projects to display learning. I worked with another teacher, Miss Tricia Lewis is another one, an English teacher here at Red River, and she said, I want to be a part of this too. And so we kind of started collaborating on how we would do this. But the hard part for me is how do we get students to feel like they need to read a novel in order to solve a problem? Because learning has to be relevant for them. And so we split up some of the reading into five or six different novels, Huck Finn being one of the centerpieces, but it was many others, more current novels. And so they had a choice. And then they had to use that along with a whole bunch of other articles and determine how they wanted to address the question of promoting and protecting human rights. And we talked about that we'll be creating a human rights museum, and this will be on public display. We'll be inviting the public, and when kids hear that, their faces immediately are like, oh my gosh, wait a minute, I'm going to have to work on this. And it's amazing to watch that. Like, that is absolutely the key to project-based learning, to innovations class, to the future of education, is how can we get the public involved and have an audience that's bigger than the teacher? Because when I read the papers that I'm grading right now that were only for me, there is a lot less that went into those. And when I look at what these kids put in and the time that I had kids come before school and they say, okay, I took these pictures. I was at the Ember last night and I had these people coming for the photo shoot. Can I borrow this projector? And I mean, there's just these ideas that are coming out of the kids that are so much bigger than writing a paper.
Sometimes people hear project-based learning, collaboration, and they get a sense, well, two of the kids aren't doing anything. How do you keep everyone engaged and personalize the learning a little bit?
One thing I think is that groups need to be small. So I think that's a really important basic first step. I always say no more than three and, you know, two or three people. But then having students determine what their strengths are before they make groups, I think is a really important thing. So when we go into a human rights project, we have somebody who's going to be doing some of the writing, somebody who's going to be the creative type person who is more of the arts involved in creating the art, and somebody who would be a little bit more of a researcher. And so they'll all do this work together, but they've already determined that they have a little bit of a skill that is that in that direction. So it kind of gives them a little ownership there. so that when something needs to be done, it isn't just what happened with this group, it's who's more accountable for that piece. And then it has definitely been something, and I've tried to do that in every project-based unit, is that they have a little bit more responsibility for their part, and then they see it all come together that way.
You mentioned another project where you're working to enhance the image of Grand Forks Red River, and you mentioned a real success story with that project as well.
Yeah, so this year will be the third year we've done this one. It is how do you, as a PR firm, how do you promote Red River in a positive way? We brainstorm what is the perception of Red River High School and students and young people, and what do we want to do to change that? And so the problem is something that you can go in many different directions. And what I've seen is that kids want to have an answer. And that's one of the biggest reasons why we need project-based learning. It's because kids want an answer. They want to know what to do. They say, is this right? Should I do this? And so immediately you're going to have, if anyone tries this, you will automatically have about 7 kids who have food drives, coat drives, book drives. The word drive will drive you nuts. I mean, it is unbelievable how many kids will propose a drive. And so one of the biggest keys is get past your first idea. Your first idea is not your best idea, because it's not your first idea or their fifth idea. It's the 20th idea or more that finally leads you to something that is new. And you tell a kid that and they automatically stop and say, there's no way I could get to 20. So I say, okay, you and your group, you need 20 things that you could possibly do right here. And they look at you like you're crazy. And so then they start and they go, I got to 20. And then, okay, what'd you get to? We actually started to think about this. So basically what happens in this unit is they work to solve the problem. They propose their idea. Then they go and carry out their campaign or their project in some sort of way in the community. Then they come back and they tell the judges, the panel of judges, and they present what they have done, and the judges choose a winner. So there's a winner for each class. The first year we had, one of the winners was 2 guys who wanted to mow lawns and then donate the money to the Humane Society. It was called Cuts for Mutts. They made a fantastic video, and they raised about $60, and they mowed about 3 lawns, I think it was, and I believe that most of them were related to them. So that was one. And then the other one was an elementary innovations day where kids went to an elementary school for an hour and they had multiple stations where they taught kids some different things to look forward to the future. So the next year, I know I'm better at this. My kids are going to be better. And they see some of the examples and they're like, okay, I can top this. And the competitive spirit really kicks in a little bit. And so I had one group, one of the winners, one of the class winners, they had competitive lemonade stands. The original idea was we could have a lemonade stand. I said, okay, that's great. Think times 10. Well, there's 3 of us. We could have 3 lemonade stands. Okay, yeah, bigger. How can we get this bigger? How can you get more people involved? Well, I have another friend. Maybe I could ask that friend. I said, okay, how do you, times 10 though. I mean, we're going one step at a time. Let's keep going. And so finally we got to the idea of you put a sign up on your lemonade stand. You designate a charity that you're going to donate to. And then you have multiple lemonade stands spread across the city. And whoever raises the most money at their lemonade stand gets to donate all the money raised to the charity of their choice. And so they ended up raising about $650 to the Humane Society. And that was the winner. So there was one. I said, okay, now, see, like, these things are really starting to happen. And then the one that absolute winner so far was a group that had a cancer walk, and they raised over $6,000 to be donated to cancer research. And it was an incredible day. There were hundreds of people that showed up, and it was really cool to watch the kids, how, one, they took and embraced inviting the public, and 2, they reacted to when problems were thrown at them, and they had small failures, like not being able to reserve the shelter at Lincoln Park and panicking and not getting the t-shirts done in time, and they had selling t-shirts. And so they had to adjust and readjust and keep coming back. And it's just really cool because those are the skills that we need.
Yeah. You're talking about collaboration, critical thinking, creativity. I mean, those are the things that you're really squeezing out of these projects.
Absolutely. And I know that I'm just keep bragging about kids, but they're fantastic. So I'm going to give you one more that was a very close winner, or close to the winner. And this was something that led into our innovations project for this year, was a culture fair. And so these kids proposed that we have a large group of new American students at Red River. And it is often seen that we have 2 different tracks of students, where there's a group over here and there's groups over here. And this group said, we want to help students become a little more together. And they wanted to have a culture fair where students interacted instead of just watching. We have a culture night that's very good, and it's a celebration of cultures. But in culture fair, this group wanted to say that they would have students who would be cooking food, who would be dancing and then have other people dance with them and be sharing stories. And they ended up carrying this out in innovations class. And so that's the idea and how they all really tie together in project-based learning, innovations class, and it's just that's where it all comes together in education.
I want to give you at least one more chance to talk about your kids, because another another example really caught my attention, another success story, I guess you could call it. I wanted you to tell me about the group of girls that you had that worked on the preventing the sexual assault. What a significant project that was to undertake for them.
Absolutely. So this is my first year of innovations class, and we start the year and we say, okay, tell me one thing you're passionate about. And there are a few of the girls that wrote feminism, and they put it up on the board and they said, all right, yeah, I'm interested in feminism. Very general idea. But then they started to get to the idea of, well, what do we want to actually accomplish? What is something that we think is a problem that we need to work to solve? And so they looked at a sexual assault and the idea of rape culture and just what could be done in order to promote and just keep people aware of what's going on, whether it's in high school or college. And these are high school seniors. So they read a book, Missoula, which is Rape in the Justice System in a College Town. And so these girls, all three read this and then said, this needs to be read in our high school curriculum. So they went to English teachers and proposed that. We had some people who were on board and thought that this would be definitely worth doing. And then they were making this video along the way, and they had – it's a fantastic video that has – features Red River students speaking pretty strong language about what needs to be done and how sexual assault is something that needs to be stopped and how we need to respect people. And it was very well done. So they ended up getting a little feedback on this video – or I'm sorry, on the book and the idea that maybe this woman had a little bit of a problem in the book, and it was a comment that it is something that they're fighting. That was exactly the point of the video. And so they were offended. They were angry, and they came to me and said, should we keep doing this? If people don't think we should do this, maybe we should stop. And it was then when we said, that's the point. If you make somebody upset, you start to ruffle feathers, you get people to start thinking differently, you're onto something, because their ideas were tested. They had to decide if they were going to bail on their ideas or stand and do what they wanted to do and what they knew was right. And it relit their fire. They finished their video. They presented to health classes. This video caught the eye of Senator Heidi Heitkamp. So she ended up visiting our class, and they ended up speaking all events on campus at UND for the Women's Center. And it was an incredible experience to watch them get out of our school, make connections in North Dakota, from politicians to leaders in our community at the CVIC, and to look at what that does for their future. They're no longer just a group of three girls who had an idea and presented it to a teacher. They know people, and now they have connections that they can use in their life.
In a bigger picture, you attended the Governor's Innovation Summit last year, and you said it really impacted you. The legislature obviously passed Senate Bill 2186. Teachers have been innovating as long as there have been classrooms, I think, so it's not like just started last May or something. But there really is a culture of innovation that's being pushed forward. How is that energizing you and other teachers?
The culture is the energizing part. The idea that people are wanting more from education, and it isn't just that you're doing it over here and I heard somebody else is doing it over here. It's people getting together and sharing what's happening. And that's where energy, I think, is really coming from. It's impacted our school district in Grand Forks. We have an innovative education committee that we've now started with teachers from elementary through high school to our new superintendent and technology directors and people, principals, and all kinds of different people. And what the summit has done, I think, for a lot of people is open their eyes to possibilities. And that, I think, is the biggest key. Because as a teacher, I liked when my kids did cool stuff. But I had no idea what cool stuff was out there. When I saw Most Likely to Succeed, when I read books by Tony Wagner, and when you see what is happening that is way beyond what I had ever imagined, it leads me to rethink everything I do. As I was on my way to the summit And I'm driving, and I called about three or four AP teachers to talk about AP as a version of test prep, how much test prep goes on, is everything we do test prep? And I'm going, holy cow, how much test prep do I do in my class? And it's this idea of standards. We need standards, but standards tell us what's the minimum that can be done. And if all we're doing is the minimum, we're not going to see these amazing things that are developing skills from students. And we have to go beyond what is listed in a standard to do that. And so I think that's one of the biggest things, that if we're going to change education, it has to come from that culture. And it has to come from the culture from teachers, our leaders, and parents and students. Because when I get seniors in high school who come to my class, and all they think about are, well, is this going to get me an A? And what does this mean for my grade? And, you know, this matters for my ropes that I'm going to be wearing at graduation if I get an A in this class. And all I think is, this is not the point of education. And it's a culture that needs to shift. We have to get away from the question of, did you get your homework done? To, you know, what did you learn? What are you going to do? What are you going to change? What do you disagree with in school? What's going to happen? What are you going to make happen outside of school? And like I said, that culture comes from all over, but the Innovation Summit is pushing that.
Just wanted to end allowing you to talk about your obvious passion for teaching, for learning, for students, and where that's leading in the future.
I think school has ended up being a place where students get through and they have to get done with in order to move on to the next part of their life. And I think that what we can do as teachers and as in North Dakota and in the United States and all over is that we have the opportunity to have students say that this is my life and my life has started already and I can make relevant things happen now. And there's a student that I distinctly remember when I had asked this question. I said, do you want to have the secretary job or do you want to be the CEO that makes all the decisions and comes up with new ideas and has all this great potential? I just want to be told what to do. And this happens so often in our schools. We have kids who are begging to not be told what to do all the time. And they're not begging out loud. They've given up. They've given up begging. And it's starting so at such a young age with the idea of that tests are the only thing that matters. They don't see relevance. They're begging in different ways that are rebellious, that are they're not being valued. And I think that as educators, we need to value what our students can do, the potential they have, what they can do and see meaning to find their passions. Because it's one thing to say, oh, go find your passions. It's another thing to actually give students opportunity to see what they're good at.
Grand Forks Red River High School English teacher Eric Sanders talking with podcast host Tom Gerhart. The Cutting Ed Podcast is a collaboration of North Dakota United, Prairie Public, the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, and philanthropist Ted Dinter-Smith. Dakota Date Book is next.
Support is provided by Otter Tail Power Company, providing safe, reliable, and affordable electricity for more than 100 years, while balancing community, economic, and environmental commitments. Always.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. Many people in the U.S. feel that capitalism, police brutality, and racism prevent them from reaching their goals. Some have suggested that the American dream itself is a lie. Our next guest is going to challenge this skepticism. He's going to argue that success is a personal choice and that immigrants provide all the proof one needs of American potential. So join me and my guest, Jason D. Hill, for An Immigrant Defends America, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Date Book for June 4th. On this date, in 1918, the Bismarck Theater featured a performer, quote, hailed by women as the most beautiful example of their sex, unquote. However, Julianne L. Tinge was not a woman, but a female impersonator, and one of the most celebrated and highest paid performers in the United States. L. Tinge was born William Dalton in Massachusetts in 1881. As a boy, he showed an affinity for performance and was fond of dressing up in ladies' clothing. Dalton's affinity was encouraged by his mother, but prohibited by his father. In the 1890s, the Dalton family moved to Butte, Montana, a booming mining town where several saloons and vaudeville houses sprang up. As a teenager, Dalton performed as a dancer in the saloons, dressed as a woman. The practice was not uncommon in the rough railroad and mining towns due to the fact that the incoming population was predominantly male and a respectable young woman would not have been found near a saloon. Dalton's employment in the saloons was short-lived. When his father found out, Dalton was swiftly sent back to Boston to work as a store clerk. Yet his love of theater persisted. He studied dance and became active in amateur theater. It was during this time that the female alter ego of Julian Eltinge was born. In 1904, he made his New York Broadway debut in Mr. Wicks of Wickham, which rocketed him to worldwide acclaim. By 1912, Eltinge, a.k.a. Billy Dalton, was not only a Broadway headliner, a theater was named in his honor, the Eltinge 42nd Street Theater in Manhattan. However, a lesser-known theater was also named in his honor in Bismarck, North Dakota. In 1919, E.A. Hughes announced that his newly planned vaudeville and movie house would be named the Eltinge. According to the Grand Forks Herald, quote, the fair Julian, unquote, was an old friend of the Hughes family. And apart from the social ties, the air of glamour that accompanied Eltinge's name likely figured into Hughes's business decision. In 1920, the Eltinge Theater opened on 3rd Street in Bismarck. Eltinge's career straddled the era of vaudeville and motion pictures. Throughout the 1920s, he starred in several films while still performing in vaudeville tours. However, by the late 1930s, cultural tastes changed, and the trend of female impersonation was no longer regarded as lighthearted entertainment. Some cities even enacted laws against what were now called drag performances. Eltinge's career declined, and in 1941, he passed away after a performance in Manhattan. The old theater building in Bismarck went through a couple of name changes and was eventually demolished. However, Eltinge's legacy lives on in the preserved cinema productions. As for the original Eltinge Theater in Manhattan, well, it's now a movie theater. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Maria Witham. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
You've heard of speed dating, right? Well, we have something akin to that. It's ASCA, Prairie Public's new initiative that aims to break down barriers and facilitate meaningful conversation and a deeper understanding. Here it is. Get 8 people from a group that's in the news and find 8 other sincerely curious folks who want to know more about them. We hope to spur lively one-on-one and group discussions and make connections with others in our communities. We'll interview participants for radio features that will be broadcast on Prairie Public so the conversations can have real statewide impact. Interested? We're looking for askers and answerers for our first ASCA chat, Ask a Native American, August 11th at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. You can sign up now or find out more at prairiepublic.org.
Tuesday on Main Street, we'll talk about a very special map that only recently has been recognized for its importance to the Lewis and Clark expedition. We'll discuss the map's significance on Tuesday with humanities scholar Clay Jenkinson. And in Grand Forks, Season 2 of North Dakota Shakespeare will present Twelfth Night. We'll talk about the show with artistic director Stephanie Vats Murray and costume designer Amber Cook. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.